Okay, I show 8:30, so that ought to be time to start. I'll repeat because some folks have just come in. My name is Mark Lanier. I'm talking about a book, Christianity on Trial. Is this as loud to you as it is to me? Can we turn it down just a smidgen so I can shout without shouting? Thank you. Christianity on Trial. There's a copy of the book back there with your name on it, if you'd like one. Please grab one and don't hesitate. They'll be there on the way out, and I'm delighted for you to have it. A number of you were here yesterday, and I didn't chase you off. That's a good sign. A couple of new, fresh faces today. It's a delight to see you as well. My name is Mark Lanier, and I live in two worlds. I live in a world of my occupation, which is that of a trial lawyer, and I travel the country trying cases. You can Google me and see that it's something I really do. I don't just sort of claim to do it. It is my occupation and one for which I have a great deal of personal satisfaction and reward in what I do. But in addition to that, I live in an alternate world where I don't really practice law. I'm really spending my time and energy studying scripture and trying to figure out how to teach it. And so I live in a world where I teach and interact with people on that basis as well. And that's actually the world that I enjoy the most. I studied to be a preacher. I have a degree in biblical languages, but I use that mainly as I guess, a hobby because I don't make a living off of it. But being a lawyer enables me to say, take a copy of the book and read it or give it to someone you think might enjoy it. All right. We got a few of the last people that have come in. Now we're going to get started. Yesterday I told you when we started this that the key to the approach that I think we should be using as Christians when we talk about what we believe and why we believe it is this idea of the burden of proof. Our problem in America is we have been influenced so much by the sciences that we think faith means certainty. And sometimes we look at that passage in Hebrews and we think, well, maybe that means certainty. In terms of a scientific intellectual certainty, that is not what faith is. You cannot have scientific certainty about matters of the import that we're talking about when we talk about faith. You can't even do that in a courtroom. So in a courtroom, before I win, I have to prove something, but proving it is not certainty, because no one could ever prove anything with certainty. Proving it, rather, is what's more reasonable than not. What is the greater weight of credible evidence? What do we look at and say, yeah, I think that's better than the alternatives. That makes more sense to me. And yesterday we talked about that in terms of, is there a God? And I said that not only do we need to think about that, but once we've thought about that, we need to think about what kind of God is he? And I'm skipping over some of the book from after yesterday to get to something of a new subject area today. Today I'd like to talk to you about what's more reasonable than not, about another aspect of Christian faith. And I call this biolinguistics and the communicating God. Now, if you and I were going to be in a courtroom today, and I was, I spent 3 months so far this year in trial, January, February, and March. And every day I'd go to court, federal court in Dallas, Texas. And I'd every day be cross-examining or direct examining a witness. And every day I'd be there with my team. The other side lawyers would be there with their team. I had my clients there. I had the judge there. But do you know who else was there every day? The court reporter. Because a court reporter takes down everything that's said with this magic machine. This machine's got 22 keys on it. Doesn't do lowercase letters, just uppercase letters. It's got the vowel sounds, A-E, or A-O, E, and U, and then it's got the consonants. Now, in English, when we're talking, we use about 40 different sounds. We put them together in different ways, and they make up our vocabulary. Court reporters don't type words in the sense of letters. A court reporter is not simply a really fast typist. A court reporter is typing syllables because each syllable has a sound. Each syllable has a sound, and those sounds are what a court reporter's typing. So when you read the little paper that comes out, if they're not using a computer, if you sound out those letters, you can actually kind of make some sense out of what they're saying. Not a lot, because it's really goofy how they wind up doing it. But you've got 22 keys for 40 sounds, because that's generally how we talk. Now I want to take you another step. You have 225 muscles that activate every second you speak. It's not just those in the picture, because you've got them also, your diaphragm, your lungs, you've got a number of different things. I've just put some of them up here in the picture. But every second you speak, you've got 225 muscles that activate. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment, because this is very important. This is class participation. You ready? All right. If I have a ladder here, and I climb the ladder, I would say, I climb the ladder, right? Say it, I climb the ladder. Okay, but if I want to tell you what I did yesterday when I did that, I want to put it into the past tense, I would add ED and say it with me, I climbed the ladder. Very good, y'all are. Okay, now, let's say instead of meeting here, we're meeting on the Santa Monica Pier, and we've got fishing gear. So that in the present tense, I would say, I fish. Okay, say it with me, I fish. Now let's say we did it yesterday, and we want to talk about it in the past tense, we want to add ED, we would say, I fished. Okay, do you know what you just did? When you changed climb into the past tense and made it climbed, you added ED and you pronounced it, climbed. When you had fish and you put it into the past tense and you added ED, you in your mind changed that ED to a T. And you said, I fished. You didn't say, I fished. I fished. You said, I fished. F-I-S-H-T. Now, you have a whole different set of muscle movements for those 225 muscles when you say fished instead of fished. Did you think to yourself, he's wanting me to put fish into the past tense. That means I'm going to need to pronounce it like a T. So I'm going to need to move my tongue more toward the front of my teeth as I contract the back of my jaw so that I can pronounce right in front of all of these people and not be embarrassed. Nah, you just did it. And some of you might know the language grammar rule for, or phonology rule, actually, we should call it, for why you pronounce the ED as a T at the end of fish as opposed to climb. But I'll bet most of you don't even know that. Did you know that we have grammar rules that we cannot even figure out yet? But they're rules. We just can't figure them out. That's one of the reasons we cannot teach computers to do creative talking. Because we don't have all of the grammar rules even figured out yet. But they're in us, appear, even though they're not in our conscious thought. Now, there's an evolutionist from England, a great biologist named Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley said, "The possession of speech is the grand distinctive character of man. It's hardwired into us." Now, my mom has an African gray parrot. His name is Alex. Actually, he's a she. But mom doesn't know that. Alex has a vocabulary of well over 100 words. Alex can say things like, "Alex is a cowboy bird. Yeehaw!" Alex can say, "Hello." Alex can imitate a fire alarm. That's how my mom got Alex. The owner of Alex got tired of that. Alex has a vocabulary, but Alex is not a speaker in the sense that we're talking about. All right, next class experiment. You ready? Listen carefully to this sentence. Mark Lanier came to Elkins Auditorium, and he addressed nearly 100 people, explaining to them why they turned the ED in fish to a T when they spoke. Now, did y'all follow that sentence? Do you realize I just said a sentence that's never in the history of humanity been said before, probably. Never in the history of humanity, which means you've never heard that sentence before in your life, and yet you understood it. And the reason why most phonologists will say is because of something Noam Chomsky put forward in the 1950s when he radically changed our understanding of language. Noam Chomsky, teaching at MIT at the time. By the way, still alive today, I think. Mega radical. But he's probably really speaking almost nonstop about this whole Donald Trump thing. Because in some ways, I mean, this guy's like bizarro, Noam Chomsky, bizarro on the politics scale. And I'd just love to talk to him about all of this, but totally side point. The structure of language is biological to the human brain. He started what's called the nativist movement or understanding. Here's what he said. Before Noam Chomsky, the idea was we know language because it's taught to us, and but for that exposure, we would not really be language people. Hence, you take a baby boy and you stick him in the jungle to be raised by apes, and he's working hard to be able to say, "Me, Tarzan, you, Jane." Okay? But what Chomsky said is, no, it's actually genetically wired into our brain. We are actually hardwired for language. It's the reason our brain does things grammatically that we can't even understand and explain and write out. There are people who get their PhDs and write doctoral dissertations on the subject of what is the rule for this grammar issue. Generally, those people are coming out of the philosophy department. But it's because, and it goes back to what I said about computers. We don't even understand these rules well enough to put them into a computer, for a computer to be able to understand a brand new sentence in that way. So this is just the way our brains work. This is how we're wired. If any of you took Greek, or even if you didn't take Greek, you're familiar with this Greek word, logos. Unless you learn to pronounce your Greek in Lubbock, in which event it's logos. we combine the short O and the long O in Greek, and it's all the same to us. Logos or logos in the Greek. Anybody know what it means? Word? Well, yeah. John 1, 1, NRK, hein ho logos, in the beginning was the word. But it means more than word. What do we get from that word in our English today? Logic. Or ology, as in anything you want to have a study of. Anthropology. Greek word anthropos is man. Anthropology, the study of man. Soteriology, the study of salvation. Greek word soterios, salvation. So theology, the study of God. Theos is God. So ology, or logos, not only means word in the Greek, but the breadth of meaning in the Greek for that, the semantic range is better than word meaning. The semantic range for logos includes your reasoning, thinking of sorts, rationality, words, logic. Why? Because we think in words. Our brains use words for thought. There's a reason that I'm speaking to you instead of pantomiming. Because our, you know, even if someone is deaf, they learn a sign language because they think in language. The words form in your brain. It's how we are wired. We are different than the animal world in this regard. You with me? All right, now that you know all of that, I want to ask you this question. If we've already gotten over the subject of is there a God, and we decided it's reasonable to think there is, if we've already gotten over the subject what kind of God is he, and we decided he is a God who is interested in humanity, involved, if you will, by his own volition. If there is a God with personality, tough human word, anthropomorphism, but if there's a God of personality, then here's my question. Is it reasonable to expect God to communicate to us through words? See, we have a whole host of people who are brought up today, young people, people in their 20s, who readily say, I'll accept the idea there's a God. But Scripture? I'm not going there. You know, this is the musings of a bunch of people over time that have been written down. They may have been scripted, Scripture, Latin for writing. It may have been scripted, but it's not holy Scripture. It's just writings. And I look at the way we're hardwired as humans, and I come to the exact opposite conclusion. What's the most reasonable expectation? If there is a God, and he really cares about me and wants to communicate with me, I would be absolutely stunned if he didn't use words to do it. That's the way I'm wired. For me, it's not a question of are there scriptures. For me, it's a question of which ones are the scriptures. Am I going to find it in the Bible? Am I going to find it in the Bhagavad Gita? Am I going to find it in wherever? Is it in the Quran? Is it in the Book of Mormon? If it's in the Bible, which Bible? Catholic, Protestant, or Jew? The question for me is not, is there Scripture? It's which Scripture is holy. And to determine that, I want to read those scriptures. And I want to see which one makes the most sense of the world, like we were talking yesterday. The world without and the world within. Now, sometimes that means I've got to adjust my view of what Scripture is, because I have a tendency to want to read Scripture as if I wrote it, and I forget that I'm looking at it to see God's communication through that. And so I need to understand it for what it claims to be and how it claims to be here. But that's just part of the interpretation process. So I go into more in this chapter, but this is the key idea. So is it reasonable to think that Scripture might be real? I think absolutely. Next chapter. I want to talk to you about reality and truth. I was visiting with the gentleman down here that spent some time at Wycliffe Hall in 2011. I don't know if he knew Nick Bostrom or not. Nick was not associated with Wycliffe Hall, but Nick is certainly associated with Oxford. I'm going to take a poll. How many of you have heard of Nick Bostrom? Apart from some of you who've read the book. Look at that. No hands up. None. None. And y'all are smart people. Or you would have gone to a different session. Nick Bostrom is, by all accounts, on everybody's list, one of the top thinkers in the world. He is in Oxford. And if he walks down the street, there is buzz that follows him. If he were giving a lecture at Oxford in this auditorium, if we could transport this auditorium to Oxford, it would be filled. It would be standing room only. Nick Bostrom has made some ideas about reality that sound almost goofy to many of us. But I want to tell you what it is. You ready? How many of you have a computer? Everybody. I mean, you got a cell phone, you got a computer. Nick Bostrom says, and computer scientists tend to agree, that we will progress to a point, assuming that we're not all self-annihilated or the Lord doesn't return, we will progress to a point where computers are able to have programs, program modules, that actually think like people. So that a computer programmer could take a massive computer with these modules that think like people and set up a hypothetical world to test ideas, to see how people might react to this, that, or the other. Program the module where the individuals in the module have memories and process data. After all, Bostrom would tell you, and many scientists would agree, all we are is electronics in our chemistry set called the brain. And if all we are is electronics in a chemistry set called the brain, living by the laws of nature, then we ought to be able to take those electronic impulses somehow and turn them into a computer module. So that each one of us, with our electronic brain, which is memories, which is all of these, you know, thoughts that we have, infused by the chemicals of serotonin and other things that make us happy when we think about some things and melancholy about others. If that's what we are, then why not make that into a computer program? So that we've got a computer program with Matthew, with John, with Elaine, Ron, Rodney. We put a computer program together, and all of a sudden we see how these little modules interact with each other. Then we can experiment and integrate things. Now, if we can reach that point, Bostrom says, then how do we know we haven't reached it already? And how do we know that you and I aren't really just modules inside a computer program? And this game we call life is really just someone's experiment. and our thoughts of specialness and creativity and independence and individuality. It's really just our computer program for our module. Now that may sound bizarre, but one poll I saw in Oxford of the smart elite Oxford professors says that somewhere in the range of 35%, one-third or so, of the professors think there is a realistic chance that Bostrom may be right. Isn't that bizarre? But it does raise the lifelong question, how do you know what's real? How do you know if you're living in the Matrix? Or the Truman Show. Remember that one? This reality check, if you study the history of philosophy and thinking and ideas, this reality check took on a new direction with René Descartes. Descartes is famous for, he wrote a lot in Latin, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. You've heard that? It's the source of, I think, one of the funniest jokes in history that no one has ever laughed at, period. I have told this joke in front of hundreds and hundreds of people. No one has ever laughed at this joke. I'm going to tell it to you. And I want you to think about seriously whether or not you want to laugh. So René Descartes goes into a bar and he orders a drink and he drinks it. And then he orders a second and he drinks it as the bar is closing down. The bartender says to René, "Hey René, I got to close down the bar. Would you like one more drink?" Descartes says, "I think not." And poof, he disappeared. See, I think, therefore I am. He said, "I think not." Poof, he disappeared. Okay, the streak goes on. So here's what Descartes said. Before Descartes, people thought truth was based really upon just empiricism, history, and what worked, if you will. So history and experience was the basis of truth. And Descartes came along and is considered the father of rationalism by many because Descartes said, "I'm not going to believe something simply because of history and experience. I will only believe because my mind helps me get there rationally, gets me there rationally. What is real? How do I know this life isn't just a dream?" He says, "Well, I'm going to start with this. I'm thinking, cogito, I think. Therefore, I am. If I wasn't thinking, I wouldn't exist. But the very fact that I think means I must exist. I think, therefore, I am." And from there, Descartes says, "I'm only going to build what is rational to be built. And I'm only going to accept as truth what I can logically prove and accept." So, for example, he used a beehive. Under the old way of thinking of experience and history, you see a beehive and you believe in the beehive. The beehive produces wax. And actually, it's the wax that Descartes used. You take the wax from the beehive. I can use all five of my senses on that wax. I can press the wax with the sense of touch. I can see the wax with my eyes. I can smell the wax. I can thump the wax against the wall and I can hear the wax. I can taste the wax. I got all five senses, didn't I? Okay, close call. All right, so Descartes says I can do all of that. But you know what happens? You put that wax on heat and it melts. And it's not wax anymore. And so Descartes said, our senses, in like manner, can fool us. Because that wasn't really reliable for what the truth was behind that substance we thought was wax. So he says it's ideas that are reliable, not our senses. So don't do anything based on experience. Do it based upon reason. Now, into that, we come to this question. Is it reasonable to find truth as something that's revealed externally rather than internally generated? I don't have a clue what Jesus looked like. I just grabbed that picture because that's what everybody thinks he looked like in the public. That's probably pretty inaccurate. He was a Middle Easterner. He would have had much darker skin and likely hair. But so don't judge my historical accuracy. The concept here is Nick Bostrom, Rene Descartes, and Jesus on this issue of what is true and what is truth. The Gospel of John and the book of 1 John use the Greek for truth more than I think the rest of the New Testament put together. I could be wrong. I haven't counted it in a long time. But that's the way it is in my memory. Truth is a really big word in the Gospel of John. Jesus says in the Gospel of John, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes to the Father but by me. It's in John. Pilate says to Jesus, what is truth? It is in the concept is in the New Testament, but it's and in the Old Testament, but it's very deeply embedded in the writings of John, that truth is not simply something we generate from within us, but truth is something that has been revealed to us. See, Descartes wanted to go all the way up and prove just logically, step by step, starting with, I think, therefore I am, all the way up to the existence of God. And he thought he had proven that. Subsequent philosophers pointed out some errors in his logic and said you can't prove God when you get up to there. But the problem is, as a result, some people who are rationalists say, if I can't build up to the knowledge of, I will not accept it as true. Hence, I am at best an agnostic, more likely an atheist. What the Bible teaches is not that we're able to build up to an understanding of the existence of God and who He is by our own logic. The Bible teaches that we understand who God is by His revelation. Now, that does not make Christianity illogical. In fact, I would suggest to you Christianity is hyper-logical. And here's the reason why. I have yet to meet anyone with flawless logic. Our son is as smart a kid as I've ever met in my life. He's 31 years old. He's smarter than a tree full of owls. I mean, he's just really smart. Undergraduate degree in philosophy at Cornell, Ivy League school. Master's, Oxford. PhD, Oxford. Postgrad in philosophy, Hebrew University. Instructor, philosophy and logic, Oxford. He and his buddies from Oxford are all just really, really smart. And I love to engage with them because you know the wonderful thing about philosophers? They're still writing doctoral dissertations because they're still finding new things to either fix or to think of. Philosophy, after thousands of years, has yet to figure it all out. Now, that ought to tell us something. We don't need anybody to fix 2 plus 2 is 4. We got that. We got that down pretty good. But this whole concept of philosophy is one where the human brain and our logic, building upon itself rationally, is not able to achieve ultimate answers. We have fallen brains, the Bible tells us. You can take it out of biblical terminology and use everyday terminology. We're flawed in our thinking. And so there are truths that are out there that we're not able to figure out on our own. I don't care how smart you are. Look, I got news for you. There is a finite number of stars in the universe. And that number is either even or odd. I'm confident of that. So my question to you is, prove to me which it is. Well, you can't. Because you're limited in your knowledge, you're limited in your brain power, and it doesn't mean, well, there must not be an odd or an even number of stars. Well, yeah, it's one or the other. We just can't figure out which it is. The human brain has limitations. If we're going to try and understand the true nature of things without some outside revelation, then it's ridiculous to think we'll actually arrive at a conclusion. So Scripture teaches that if we're going to understand God as fully as we're able to, notice I didn't say fully as we're able to, we will need God to reveal Himself to us. Now, that doesn't mean that we're illogical in the sense that, oh, well, logic must be terrible because you have to just take a blind leap of faith for God. Oh, no. If the revelation we receive from God, Scripture being the bulk, if the revelation we receive from God does not comport with the world as we see it, then we've got a tension that needs resolution. Maybe we don't understand God right from the Bible or understand the Bible right, but it may be that we don't understand the world right. Or maybe there's a flaw in our thinking. But the idea that we need revelation to understand God does not mean that Christianity is without reason, and it does not mean that we are irrational in our faith. It is something that I think is very rational because it means we recognize our limitations and that there are some things we cannot know on our own. But it's also rational because once we have that revelation, I'm still convinced it's what makes most sense of the world around us. It's the ay caramba moment. It's like, oh yeah, now I understand why I am the way I am. Now I understand why people are the way they are. This makes sense. Now I understand why I do things I don't want to do. Now I understand why the things I want to do, I don't do. It makes sense. Okay, we got 6 minutes left for today. I got a lot I want to get to tomorrow, because tomorrow I want to challenge you on the resurrection of Jesus and looking at it. So there's two stages involved in that, maybe three if we've got enough time. So I want to give you just one more thing to look at that's kind of related to what we're talking about today. If Noam Chomsky had a human adversary in the world of his thoughts, it would have been B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner was a behavioral psychologist. And by most anybody's list, one of the top three psychologists of the 20th century. And while, for example, Noam Chomsky taught that language is ingrained in our brain, and I will say time has borne that out, 95% of phonologists and behaviorologists would agree with Chomsky at this point. It's just kind of like the gimme, okay? But when he was first coming out with that, his big opponent was B.F. Skinner, who was a behaviorist, who said, no, language is taught. It's all taught. And if you take Tarzan out of the schools, then he's going to be lucky to get, you know, Jane. I mean, it's just that taught. Skinner said, all we are is a sack of chemicals. Now, our sack of chemicals gets exposed to different things. I've had the honor of knowing Dean Ron Phillips, dean of the Pepperdine Law School for 27 years. Put it on the map. Writes songs. If you know him well, at the end of each year, you get a Christmas gift, a CD of songs he's written that he's had someone record, or a number of people record. And so as a result, I know him, and his sack of chemicals have affected my sack of chemicals. But it's still just a sack of chemicals. It's just that's the effect one chemical has on it, one sack has on another. So Skinner says, all we are is what genetically we've been manufactured to be as it relates to the environment in which that sack of chemicals is placed. That means you don't really have an ability to make choices. This freedom of will, this freedom that says, oh, I can do what I want, Skinner said. It's already predetermined by your chemistry and the environment's effect on it. Predetermined, everything. You know, you think, hey, I chose to come here Christianity on trial section this morning. Nah. It's just a combination of your chemistry and what you were presented with, and your chemistry as it's been fashioned by your environment. You think you're here by choice? You're not here by choice. By the same token, not only then do we not have freedom, but we don't have dignity either. I mean, I'd love to say John King is a thoroughbred stud because of all of the things he's done for LCU over his tenure. But he's not a thoroughbred stud, according to Skinner. He's just a sack of chemicals that in his environment did that with no freedom, no choice, no anything else. There's no dignity in that. You follow? Now, that's not a Christian view. The Christian view is very different. And the Christian view is that we do have freedom, we do have dignity, and we can actually make choices. And I think common sense, that's the way most of us are hardwired to know the truth anyway. The greatest point I can make on this just cracks me up. The million copy bestseller of Walden 2, but look at his big publication that Skinner is most famous for. Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Now this book, it's a Bantam paperback, my copy. It folds right here. This is the back. This is the front. Look at what the New York Times says on the front cover of Skinner's book. If you plan to read only one book this year, this is probably the one you should choose. Says the claim to the book that no one is going to ever choose to make any claim. You don't have choice. That's the point of the whole book. But we know that's wrong. And it's not the common sense answer. So tomorrow I want to talk to you, if you come back or if you know anybody that may be interested in coming, I want to talk to you about morality. I want to talk to you about the resurrection and what we can reasonably conclude from both of those. God bless you guys. I'll see many of you tomorrow, I hope.